If the synthesized virus were to be released by radio signal alone, Natalia realized there would be at least a realistic chance of foiling Dietrich Zimmer's intentions. But Zimmer had, in the best tradition of John Rourke, planned ahead. That was the one thing which John Thomas Rourke and Dietrich Zimmer held in common, aside from medical degrees and being of the same sex. Both men were the embodiment of genius, but opposite sides of the coin. Whereas John's superior intelligence had always been directed toward the good, Zimmer's was directed toward doing evil. Zimmer's plan, as Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krauss outlined it from the data revealed through raiding Zimmer's computer network, was, as Cronenberg might have described it, convoluted. The canisters of compressed air containing the airborne virus were secreted over the course of 5 years, not 20. They were placed in strategic locations throughout the civilized world. Whether or not each of these locations was pinpointed, deeper within the data, remained to be seen. And if so, were these locations encrypted in such a manner that they might not be easily identified? The personnel who had placed the canisters were murdered following much the same plan as had been utilized in the burial rites of the pharaohs of ancient Egypt. Dead men, as the expression in English went, tell no tales. A corps of trusted SS-trained fifth columnists, perhaps very much like the man who had nearly killed John through the use of a cyanide gas pistol, was enlisted to activate radio signals when given circumstances occurred, these still to be discerned as well. Blind after double blind, Dietrich Zimmer's system was all but failsafe, perhaps unable to be defeated. To jam every radio frequency possible would be impossible. Even the very stars emitted radio signals, of course. To locate and terminate, or otherwise disable, each and every one of the saboteurs might be equally impossible. All that was needed was for the contents of one canister to successfully be released, and Dietrich Zimmer's plan, if slightly slowed, would nonetheless succeed. If the data so far gleaned from Dr. Zimmer's computer network included the identities of each and every one of these saboteurs and how they could be located, it would be sufficiently miraculous that her own indecision about the existence of God, Natalia truly wanted to believe, as did the Rourkes, would instantly be washed away. Assuming that all of the saboteurs were somehow located and prevented from releasing the contents of their assigned canisters, it was equally far-fetched to believe that each of these personnel would willingly cooperate afterward, assuming each of them lived. Unless the location of each canister was correctly discerned, the canisters would eventually release their evil into the world without any help from Zimmer. The canisters were made from a type of stainless steel. The air inside the canisters would, perforce, be moist. The environment surrounding the canisters would have moisture in it as well, if only ordinary humidity. No stainless steel was truly 100% rust-proof in the long term. Stainless steels of various types were merely rust-resistant, some more than others. Eventually, at least one canister's integrity would be compromised and the contents would release. Again, Zimmer would have won and mankind would have lost. Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krauss, who had fallen silent for a few minutes in order to consult her notes, thus allowing Natalia's reverie, resumed speaking.
It is unclear at this point whether or not the nature of the inoculant Dr. Zimmer had administered to himself and his son is revealed in these materials. It may become necessary to invade Dr. Zimmer's computer network again.
If we do and he catches us, he might order the instantaneous release of the virus just to destroy us, gambling on the sub-oceanic vent not destroying the planet. And anyway, we wouldn't all die instantly. We'd keep trying to produce a biological means by which to defeat the virus, and in the hopes of success, keep working to stop the spread of the sub-oceanic rift.
Commander Darkwood's point is well taken.
It seems that whatever action we might take, Zimmer has already countered it. We have to think of something that Zimmer has somehow overlooked. Otherwise, he'll win this one, and there won't be any other ones to win or lose.
His own thoroughness might be the key to defeating him. There's a difference between meticulous, conscientious attention to detail and obsession. We know from our own observations and from Cronenberg's analysis of Zimmer that obsessiveness is there, with Zimmer's unrelenting passion for immortality. If we try to analyze Zimmer's methods from a standpoint of his being obsessive rather than being a genius, maybe we can indeed discern something that he's overlooked, perhaps by his very nature of paying such inordinate attention to detail.
I'm not trying to sound naive, but is there no way at all to either reason with him or threaten him?
The President of the United States smiled indulgently.
My dear Mrs. Rubenstein, how can we threaten him when he holds the world virtually at bay?
Perhaps we can turn his obsession against him, as Annie was getting at. Even now, Zimmer is, in the interests of humanity, surrendering his tactical nuclear warheads in order to assist in the attempt to divert the volcanic vent, which might destroy us all. What if we threaten him in the only way that he can understand?
How?
I've never been good at telling funny stories, so indulge me while I attempt to illustrate with this one. There was this American Indian lad walking about a train station in the southwestern United States. The lad walks up to various female tourists, one after the other, raising his right hand palm outward and saying, "Chance." Well, after saying this to a variety of different women, one of the women at last says to him, "I thought Indians said how." The Indian replies, and here's the point, of course, "Me know how. Me want chance." This is an obvious sexual reference, gentlemen. The point I'm making is that I think we have the perfect mechanism, that we know how. What we need is the chance.
What sort of mechanism, Dr. Rourke?
Well, Mr. President, everyone's been talking about it, and it is the obvious thing. He donated his warheads not out of any love of humanity, obviously, but because we can do something about the vent, possibly, and he cannot. Eden has a comparatively minuscule navy, virtually no sea power, and has never been interested in undersea exploration. The Nazis have nothing at all. We, on the other hand, command the greatest naval force the world has ever known, spaceships, as it were, but capable of traveling within the sea. No one on Earth has the power to stop the volcanic rift except us. What if we choose not to?
Oh, now see, that there would be suicidal, Dr. Rourke.
Suicidal? Well, what's better? All of us die in a fiery blast instantly, or we linger for weeks and months and years, dying a little bit at a time while we work to combat a constantly mutating virus, just so that we can leave a perfect planet in the hands of a madman who would corrupt the entire human race. I think the former, sir, or certainly that we convince Dietrich Zimmer that it is the former option we select. While our scientists work to discern and hopefully duplicate the inoculant Zimmer has administered to himself and to Martin, we attack on a second front. We call Dietrich Zimmer's bluff, and we offer him a deal.
What sort of deal?
His life with his Nazi comrades in his own country. He can live forever there, rule forever there if he wishes, over the men and women within his group and within Eden who chose to live with him. He would be eternal master of his own part of the world. Either that, or he dies with the rest of us.
We would rue such a bargain, Doctor.
Indeed, we would. But after we get the canister secured, after we know that we have the means by which to combat the disease, then I will kill him. To do so would be totally irrational, so he'd never suspect that I would do it. I'll kill him because he must die. Whatever guilt there might be associated with the act will be mine alone. He would never expect me to break a promise. I'll deal with the consequences of my actions, with my own conscience. We offer him life or death.
What if Dietrich Zimmer chooses death, John?
We'll still be working to combat him on other fronts. Should those efforts fail and we cannot defeat him, then I'll kill him anyway. It would be the ultimate moral sophistry to allow Dietrich Zimmer to live, to sacrifice future generations, should there be any, just to spare my conscience, or to allow him the satisfaction of knowing that even in some very small way, he had triumphed. I've predicated my life on the concept that good always triumphs and evil always fails. I'm sure over the year that some people have thought me foolish or naive for believing what I believe. To let Zimmer taste even a moment's victory would be the abdication of everything I've always believed in. It's a battle for the future of the world on the grander scale. But on a personal level, it's a battle of his ego versus mine. From the very beginning of this, from the moment he shot Sarah and kidnapped our baby, he's made this personal between himself and the family. Well, he's got a personal thing. In the 20th century and in the centuries before, there was a unique and bloody concept whereby a man would swear an oath of revenge, and nothing other than death or the achievement of his objective would dissuade him from following through on his oath. It was called a vendetta. That's what this has finally devolved to. Zimmer will die.
Sarah Rourke could not sleep this night. Fully recovered from her debilitated physical condition, aware fully, too, that she bore memories within her brain which were not her own, one feeling within her would never change, that she had been violated as surely as if she'd been raped. To be a woman was hellish at times. She was expected to let the man from whom she was in the process of being divorced avenge what had happened to her, while she sat helplessly by, waiting. She sat in the equivalent of a solarium, bright lights, plants growing in greenhouse-like conditions, the perfect facsimile of a real hospital solarium where patients, too long confined, could be exposed to sunlight without being exposed to the elements. But this was not real sunlight, only pretend. And she was aboard a submersible aircraft carrier somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, the vessel on a war footing. Sarah Rourke wondered at times what had brought her to this. Before the night of the war, she'd illustrated children's books with all sorts of nice jungle animals as characters. Then, in one night, she found herself consigned to a jungle for all eternity, her little boy killing a man who was sexually assaulting her, and her little girl never knowing a real home throughout the years of childhood. And her husband. She was married to a living legend, not a man. Soon she would not be married to him, but married to the most sensitive man she had ever met, Wolfgang Mann. And he was a German general, for God's sake. A professional soldier. Life was madness, when life wasn't terror. John would go on forever being the hero, or at least until he died. She was just too tired to be a hero's wife anymore. Too tired of the fighting and the danger and all of it. She had tried to be the heroine in the play and done rather well at it, despite insufficient preparation for the role. Then a lie was implanted in her brain by a madman, and she discovered only too late that she could not trust her own mind. She was reduced to murdering a human being she had never met in a vain attempt to engineer the death of her husband, who had loved her with perfect fidelity for half a millennium. Sarah Rourke was ashamed of what she had done, despite the fact that she was neither legally nor morally responsible. The fault was clearly not her own. She remembered the words of William Shakespeare in Julius Caesar, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." The fault was hers, regardless of the circumstances. And now, with happiness perhaps just within her grasp, the world might end. If it did, her world would end in the arms of a man she wished she had met in the 20th century rather than the 25th century. A man she wished she had married in the 20th century instead of being about to marry in what was the 26th. She loved John Rourke, and he loved her, but marriage between them was insanity. She did not love Wolfgang Mann as much, rather differently. Sarah Rourke looked up as Wolfgang Mann and the naval equivalent of an attorney entered the solarium and approached her. The naval officer was younger than either of her children, although she was biologically just in her middle 30s. And the naval officer was an adult. Another of John's masterstrokes, letting the children age into adulthood while she did not age, all through the use of cryogenics.
"Ma'am, I have the papers for the divorce. Once you've signed them, they can be sent by facsimile to Dr. Rourke." "None of my business, Mrs. Rourke, but are you and your husband sure, really sure about this?"
Sarah reached out her hand, and Wolfgang Mann took her hand in his.
"I know that a lot of people, most people, think of us as like George and Martha Washington or Garibaldi and his wife or whatever historical couple you could imagine. But we aren't anything special, John and me. We're only people. He'd be the first one to tell you that. And people make mistakes. The wise people attempt to correct them, and that's what we're doing now, correcting a long overdue error in judgment. So don't feel badly for us, son."
Michael and Annie had not been a mistake. They were the finest people that she knew, as were Natalia and Paul, their mates. And so was John. This girl, Emma Shaw, would be good for John. Sarah Rourke bit her lower lip as she took the papers and the pen from the young naval officer's hands. As she signed the name Sarah Rourke for the very last time, tears began to fill her eyes, and she let them come, hoping they would wash some things away, knowing they would not. Tim Shaw's right arm was stiff, in a way in which it had not been stiff for a very long time. It had fallen asleep, tingling as he tried to move it, the fingers stiff and thick-feeling and almost seeming to be disconnected from his body. In the half-light, half-darkness of the gray morning, filtering through the rain and volcanic ash, and at last, almost unnecessarily, through the partially open Venetian blinds, he could see Linda's face quite clearly as she lay in the bed beside him. He hadn't been a virgin since the death of his wife, but he hadn't done anything like this either. Linda Cunningham was actually 2 years younger than his daughter, and he hadn't even come close to giving himself a heart attack satisfying her. And he was certain that he had, in fact, satisfied her as well as he had satisfied himself. He was an old street cop who'd been around maybe too long. Otherwise, he would have thought he was falling in love, or had already fallen. But the only reason they were together was because the earth was shaking beneath them, and not in the romantic sense of the earth moving, just really shaking. Twice during the night, he had been awakened by mild earth tremors, but hadn't bothered to awaken the girl sleeping beside him. When she awoke, the magic would probably be over. She'd look at his overnight growth of beard, seeing all the white, which vastly outnumbered the black that formed his stubble beard, realizing the horror of being in bed with a guy his age and all that went with it. She'd be polite, get out of the apartment early on the excuse that she had to get clothes or something, and try her damnedest never to see him again. Tim Shaw would have lit a cigarette, except for two things. He'd promised Emma he wouldn't smoke in bed because it terrified her that he'd fall asleep and burn to death, and if he moved to get a cigarette and an ashtray and everything, the girl would awaken. Tim Shaw wanted the last few minutes or seconds, no matter, but he wanted them. After several minutes, objectively he knew that, but what seemed like seconds, Linda stirred, rolled over against his shoulder and opened her eyes, still sleepy-looking like a little girl's eyes. Now it would happen. He could read eyes. Reading eyes had helped him to stay alive all those years, and this morning he wondered if it had been worth it. Her eyes opened wide, almost startled. He wanted to look away, but she was so beautiful that he couldn't force himself to do it, or to say something flippant which would save his ego. He waited, letting it happen.
I love you, Tim. Can I come back tonight when I'm off duty? And every night? I love you so.
I love you too, kid. Honest to God, love you.
All through the night, they had gone over every scrap of data contained within the pirated computer records taken from Dietrich Zimmer's network, and John Rourke's resolve to do what must be done, even should he compromise his soul by promising Dietrich Zimmer life, then giving him death, had deepened. As he left the chamber in which they had conferred until well past dawn, Emma, yawning, looking young and perfect and beautiful beside him, a young, ordinary seaman approached him.
General Rourke, sir! This facsimile message has just arrived for you, sir!
Very good, son. Hang loose a minute.
What is it, John?
John Rourke saw the first line.
I'm afraid I'm without the proper pen. Does anyone... A pen? Pen, please. Please.
What is it, John?
John Rourke took the pen, placed the papers against the wall, initialed as instructed on the first page. He had insisted that Sarah receive half of everything he owned, which was a considerable amount, because of the century and a quarter of Brigadier General's pay, which had been accruing for him ever since the rank was bestowed upon him here. Sarah insisted that she required nothing, that Wolfgang Mann would provide for her, that what he wished to give her, he should give to the children instead, or otherwise do what he thought best. That was initialed, and he signed at the bottom of the last sheet.
I need a witness, sailor, and it wouldn't be appropriate for Commander Shaw to fulfill that function under the circumstances.
Aye, sir.
John Rourke handed the young sailor Emma's pen. The sailor signed the divorce decree, returning the pen.
Please fax that to Point of Origin.
Aye, sir.
Yes? I know, sailor.
As the sailor left, John Rourke looked at Emma Shaw.
If we were to step aboard one of the submarines in port and the captain of the vessel were a boarder, would that be...
Are you asking me to marry you this morning?
I guess it's legal, or would be, even though we don't have a license, and anyway, I always thought that marriage was in the heart.
If I don't tell your children and Paul and Natalia, they'd never forgive us.
You need a wedding dress, too. I'm not crazy about you getting married in a flight suit you haven't been out of in 2 days.
I'd look like an idiot in a wedding dress, John.
No, you would not. But we can wait until tomorrow if you'd like. Would that be enough time?
You're serious?
Yes, I am.
Yes, it would.
Take Annie and Natalia with you when you pick out a wedding dress. That's something neither of them would forgive if you didn't.
I love you, and I swear to God I'll make you the best wife I can be.
You know what you're getting yourself into? What if we live through this? Have you thought about that?
In every dream since you asked me, John Rourke, and before that, too, I never fell in love before.
He wanted to do something to crowd out of his mind what he had just done by signing that piece of paper. And very suddenly, with a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach, John Rourke wondered if he would ever see Sarah again. She had started all of this for him. Not the night of the war, of course, but all which had transpired since then had stemmed from his search for her and their two young children, little more than babies. As he looked to his right, he saw Annie and Michael and Paul and Natalia, too.
The hour's late, or early, depending on one's perspective. I'm sorry.
You signed the papers.
I signed the papers, yes.
Suddenly it seemed so damned stupid to him that signing something was necessary to end something which had gone on so long between them. Signing something didn't end a marriage. The marriage ended of its own force, or lack of it. Signing something was just to make other people, lawyers and judges and accountants, feel better, have something to look at and touch and read and file away for no one ever to bother reading again.
We both love you, Dad.
Michael put his arms around John Rourke. Annie came to stand at his other side, holding him. Paul and Natalia stood side by side, his best friends in the world. Natalia nodded that everything was all right. Paul would always be Paul, the truest and finest man John Rourke had ever known. And John Rourke reached out, taking Emma's hand. Annie embraced her. Michael kissed her cheek. Natalia joined them, embraced Emma. Paul took Emma into his arms and kissed her lightly on the lips.
Well, you already asked me if you thought it'd be okay to have two best men instead of one.
John Rourke turned away. He was, after all, an anachronism in the truest sense, he realized. He loved his family, and he loved them so deeply that their expression of love for him brought tears to his eyes. He let them come. In truth, he could not have stopped them. Dietrich Zimmer's favorite computer model of the effect of the virus was playing on screen before him. It was neither the most optimistic nor the most pessimistic, but instead the most realistic. Only 8% of the canisters would actually be released and function properly, disgorging into the air their entire contents. Fewer than 300,000 people would be infected by this direct method. Each of these people would infect no more than 3 people, although, according to other models, more than 5 times that number would be infected within the first 10 days. That would mean slightly fewer than 1 million people would be dying from the virus, and at the same time spreading it, but long before they knew it. These people would infect at least 3 people each, and again, those numbers were grossly underestimated. Within 3 weeks, 3 million people would be infected, already dying. But fewer than 10% of this number would realize that their lives were at all altered, let alone in mortal jeopardy. Within 16 weeks, better than 90% of the human population of the planet would be dying, fewer than 20% realizing it. Before 6 months had passed, over 96% of all human beings, regardless of where they lived, no matter how remote the location, would be dying. Many of the higher animals would be affected as well. Within 9 months, over 15% of the initially infected persons would be dead. Within 12 months, better than 75% of those initially infected would be dead. Within 2 years, better than 93% of all humankind would be dead, as well as millions of the higher animals. The human race, as it was called, would be in its last throes. Within 5 years, no human being would remain alive, except for himself, his son, and the clones he had made of them both. It would be difficult making do without assistance, without servants, but the two would somehow manage for the good of the greater purpose. And after 10 years had passed and the virus had run its course and died, conditions would be safe for the first few of the subspecies to be released, slaves to perform the necessary manual labor to prepare for the coming of the master race. Within a century, by manipulating the breeding process, the population of the Earth would be stabilized at acceptable levels and all would be in order. Order, nearly as much as life, was his fondest desire. Yet, all his planning might be for naught if the racial inferiors who postured as governors of the Transglobal Alliance were unable to stop the spread of the suboceanic rift, divert the energy within the vent without destroying the entire planet in the process. The potential irony of such a situation did not escape him, that he had successfully laid the groundwork from which humanity's brightest hour would emerge, and his plans might never come to fruition because of the very humanity he was trying to uplift. The mongrelization of the human species was what had brought about all of this from the night of the war forward. It was only fitting that the genetic stock which comprised the Rourke family would become the basis for this new world order, that the raw abilities lying dormant within their genes would at last be brought to the surface, all inferior qualities excised. And the Jew, Rubenstein, he would serve in part as the basis for the slave race, creatures in whom the ability to think beyond the most basic concepts, even the ability to talk, would gradually be bred out. It would be a perfect world. And any attempt to breed with these creatures, should some degenerate member of the new race of true men be found attempting to do so, would be at once fruitless and punishable by the most severe means possible. The slave race would be reproduced as clones only, their ability for sexual reproduction removed. Mankind would be forever pure. In future centuries, with the Earth reformed and technology exultant, he and Martin would lead the new race to the stars and beyond to master the universe as they had mastered the Earth. The human species would have attained its ultimate destiny of perfection because of his sacrifice. Whatever Dietrich Zimmer might have to endure in the years to come was as nothing when compared to that. John Rourke was being fitted for a general's dress blue uniform, which he would wear at the wedding. The wedding was to be at 4 o'clock and would be performed by a Protestant Navy chaplain rather than a ship's captain. And rather than aboard a submarine, in Midway's Central Park area, fronting the government buildings. Rourke reviewed transcriptions of the discussions with Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krauss. He was trying to understand the specific nature of the virus which Dietrich Zimmer planned to unleash upon the world. The more knowledge he acquired, the more potential he would have for succeeding in his ploy against Zimmer.
Must you wear these two handguns and this little knife, Dr. Rourke?
The civilian tailor was a large-boned, skinny man of average height, pleasant enough. This was the third time that he had asked about the double Alessi shoulder rig and the twin stainless Teutonics combat masters which John Rourke habitually wore.
Fine. Will you settle for this gun and the knife?
Rourke picked up the hip-gripped Centennial from the desk. With the little .38 and the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome, at least he would be armed.
It's a deal, Dr. Rourke.
Rourke placed the Centennial in his waistband, cross-draw, behind the left hip bone. Leaving the knife sheathed at the small of his back, he shrugged out of the double Alessi rig, setting guns and holsters onto the desktop. The tailor resumed tailoring, and John Rourke resumed reading whenever he could. This wedding business was getting out of hand. Natalia and Annie off with Emma doing all sorts of things John Rourke couldn't even imagine in preparation. After a few hours' sleep, the day had started in earnest at about 10 o'clock a.m. It was now nearly 2. Paul and Michael were nowhere to be seen either, evidently getting fitted for dress clothes, uniforms or tuxedos. Neither of them held military rank of any sort, so probably the latter. He would have preferred a tuxedo himself. After all, Emma didn't have to wear her dress uniform. But she had insisted that he wear military uniform, so he acquiesced. It was no surprise when John called her on the radio telephone, asking how she was feeling, asking about Wolfgang, asking if there were anything at all she needed, and telling her that he was marrying Emma Shaw. She had already given their union her blessing, as John had given his blessing to her forthcoming marriage to Wolfgang Mann.
Would you like to come? I can arrange transportation for you from the Paladin to here. I'd really like it if you could, Sarah, unless you don't feel up to it.
John had been looking for a way of doing nothing behind her back, being perfectly open and above board, and this was always his way. She started to give the classic answer.
Well, I don't have anything to wear.
But Sarah decided against that. She loved him still, the failure of their marriage incidental. She respected him, loved and respected her two children. For the children, for John's sake, she changed her mind.
Nothing could keep me away, John. Give Emma my best, too.
And she called Wolfgang Mann to get her out of the damned hospital. Tim Shaw had finally gotten up to go to the bathroom, as Linda was making them breakfast while he showered. When he stepped out of the shower, Linda knocked on the half-open door.
It's your daughter, by telephone from Midwake.
Tim thought there was something wrong. And what was Emma doing at Midwake, anyway? Wrapping a towel around his waist, still dripping wet, he took the cordless phone and sat down on the stool.
You all right, kid?
John and I are getting married this afternoon. We have transportation for you. Can you and Eddie come?
You sure about this, kid? Real sure?
I love him, Daddy.
That's sure enough. Yeah, I don't know how, but Eddie and I will get the time off and be there.
Who's the girl? You been keeping secrets on me?
Tommy Cunningham's kid, Linda. All grown up and a cop.
You two,
Mind your manners, kid.
Go, Dad!
Shut up!
John Rourke would not let another man shine his shoes unless that were the way in which a man earned his income. Just because he had arbitrary military rank didn't mean he needed an orderly to wait on him. A good shine on a pair of shoes was not just for looks. With shoes or boots, careful care preserved the structural integrity of the leather, guarded against scuffing, and helped to keep one's feet dry. A spit shine in the military context was absurd, on the other hand. The process of spit shining could actually damage the leather. And John Rourke might wear the uniform for a few hours, but the black navy Oxfords he would wear with it would be perfectly serviceable shoes on other occasions, with the tweed sport coat that he owned, for example. There was no sense having anything more than a good, honest shine. He set down his new shoes. The world was possibly ending, either by vulcanism on a scale unprecedented in the history of the universe, perhaps, or by the whim of a mad genius. And he was wasting precious hours getting fitted for a uniform he'd never wear again in all likelihood, and shining a pair of shoes, when his combat boots were already perfectly well shined. Wasting time. Then he opened his wallet and looked at the picture of Emma that he'd begun carrying recently. Rethinking things, John Rourke realized that he wasn't wasting time at all. James Darkwood buttoned the tunic of his dress whites. The latest data in from the Dauntless, where Dr. Thorn Rolvag was headquartered, was not promising. The speed at which the suboceanic rift was drifting eastward toward the North American plate was accelerating. The combined arsenal of tactical nuclear warheads from Eden and Eden's Nazi allies was already en route to a rendezvous with Rolvag's ship. The tactical nuclear arsenals of New Germany and the United States, including every nuclear warhead in the United States submarine fleet, were en route to the location as well. Rolvag was finalizing plans for implanting the devices, already working out the finishing touches for a detonation schedule. Because of its importance, although Rolvag would have final approval, his calculations would be reviewed by the leading scientists of the United States, New Germany, China, and elsewhere. One miscalculation might not only neutralize the potential benefit of the detonations, but might in fact speed disaster farther along. And there was to be a wedding. He did not find this frivolous, nor even incongruous. Weddings and births were the celebrations of life. The entire purpose of Rolvag's work over the volcanic rift was the perpetuation of life. Without life's celebration, its perpetuation would be meaningless. And should Rolvag's work fail, or should Dietrich Zimmer's doomsday virus be disseminated, there would be little time left for humanity in the celebration of life. Time was, in the final analysis, the most precious commodity of all. Annie Rubinstein knotted her husband's tie for the umpteenth time, at last getting it just perfect.
You look great, Paul.
Paul took a step closer and embraced her. He had told her that he clearly did not look forward to this thing, and he repeated that now.
Getting everybody together for this wedding. I don't know, but I do know I'll be glad when it's over.
He took his battered old Browning High Power from the dresser top and shoved it into the waistband of his tuxedo, the butt of the pistol sticking outside his vest. Annie turned toward the mirror to give herself one final inspection. There had been no time to find matching bridesmaids' dresses and have them fitted. If there'd really been time, she would have made the dresses for herself and Natalia, even made Emma's dress. Instead, Emma wore a perfectly beautiful long white bridal gown bought off the rack and altered on the spot. There wasn't even time to make a proper headpiece, so Emma bought a veil. She and Natalia, on the other hand, their tastes in clothing wildly divergent, had agreed with Emma on just getting long dresses of no particular style or color. Annie wore pale pink, the bodice low-cut but plain, sleeveless and strapless, the skirt packed beneath with petticoats and ankle-length, full and multi-tiered. Her hair was piled atop her head, interwoven with garlands of pink flowers. She had seen Natalia's dress, champagne-colored and probably the most perfect dress to be had at Midwake. Michael Rourke watched Natalia as she checked herself in the mirror. If she was hiding a gun or knife, and certainly she would be, he couldn't figure out where. He'd asked the color of her dress, thinking it was a shade of khaki. He was told it was called champagne. He'd had champagne, but didn't remember it being quite that color at all. It was almost sleeveless, except for little sleeve-like things just below her shoulders and over her biceps. Even though Natalia was strong for a woman, her biceps didn't look like anything at all. The front of the dress stopped so that the cleavage between her breasts was visible, forming a kind of heart-shaped look. The back was even lower, he observed as she turned around. The bottom part of the dress, nothing fancy about it, came all the way to her ankles. She wore high-heeled shoes, which made her nearly as tall as he was. Her jewelry was nothing special, just gold earrings and her regular watch, a lady's Rolex with a gold and stainless steel jubilee band. Her hair was caught up at the nape of her neck, but not with anything, just sort of woven together, but not braided.
How do I look?
Like the most beautiful woman in the world. But you always look that way.
You're sweet.
Michael picked up one of the Berettas and stuffed it inside the waistband of his pants. He didn't like vests, but a cummerbund reminded him of a sash on a pirate in a video movie. Natalia picked up her purse, a really small one that wouldn't have been practical to hold anything much larger than a 25 automatic or a mini revolver. It was the same color as the dress, so he supposed that she was stuck with it.
You all set?
Let me fix your tie, Michael.
Michael stood there while she untied the knot, then retied it. Her nails, he noticed, were painted the same color as the dress. She had a good eye for detail, but women generally did.
There! You look so handsome.
Why don't we get around to doing this the first chance we get?
Getting married?
Yeah.
The dress Emma Shaw wore was simple but gorgeous. White, of course. The dress was off the shoulder and had three-quarter length lace sleeves. The skirt was draped on both sides and very full, the train not too exaggerated. Emma looked beautiful. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna's eyes scanned the crowd assembled in the park as, beside Annie, her hands clasped around a small bouquet, she and Annie walked in Emma Shaw's train. But beneath the skirt of her dress, she had a pistol, in case the wedding turned out to be more than anyone had planned. Natalia was looking for familiar faces at which she would smile, and she was looking for faces which might somehow seem out of place. At these, she might have to shoot. Security at Midwake was at its highest level because of the man who, along with his bride, was to be the center of attention here. If the forces of Eden or their Nazi allies could assassinate John Rourke, the event would demoralize the Transglobal Alliance because John had become its very symbol, although he would have rejected the idea had Natalia or anyone else mentioned it to him. He had survived since before the night of the war, led the United States to victory over her own native land, and was leading the Transglobal Alliance, whether he was aware of it or not. Perhaps, like the American general, he would attempt to retire to his Mount Vernon, only eventually to be convinced to assume the mantle of leadership, as Washington had. Perhaps John would simply retire when this was all over, or perhaps he would find some new call to adventure. But despite the fact that the guests, virtually everyone who could pack into the park, included a significant number of naval intelligence and SEAL personnel in plain clothes or ordinary uniforms, all of them armed, the best security was that which one provided for oneself, or was provided by those whom one loved. She loved John Rourke, and she always would. It was not that she loved Michael more, nor did she love him any less, just differently. The irony of being bridesmaid to the woman who was marrying John Rourke did not escape her either. Nor did the fact escape her that even though she saw no bulges, the tuxedoed man beside Emma Shaw, her father, Inspector Tim Shaw, who would be giving her away, would certainly be armed. Probably the only persons not armed from within the wedding party, at least, were the bride and the minister. Clasped within her hands, surrounded by the trailing ribbon from the bouquet of wildflowers, was her knife. She saw Sarah Rourke, hair in a chignon, wearing a nice-looking two-piece beige dress with full skirt, standing beside Generaloberst Wolfgang Mann. Wolf in a very conservative dark gray business suit and striped tie. Natalia walked ahead. As her eyes met Sarah's, Sarah smiled quite warmly, and Natalia smiled back. Sarah, quite obviously, equally appreciated the irony of Natalia's being Emma's bridesmaid as well. By the same token, Sarah might have seen the irony as somehow fitting. Natalia was not sure. They stopped at the altar table erected there at the center of the park. John, flanked by Paul and Michael, stepped forward. Tim Shaw lifted his daughter's veil and kissed her on the lips, smiled, then went off to the folding chair which had been left for him. A very pretty young girl in an inexpensive-looking but very tasteful blue dress was sitting there and took his hand as he joined her. Emma took John's arm, and they turned to face the minister. Natalia took her place beside Annie, listening but not hearing the words of the minister, her eyes alternating between scanning the crowd for trouble and watching John's and Emma's faces. She very much wanted them to be happy. Soon, if the world survived that long and they survived with it, she would be the one wearing white and taking vows beside Michael. Very oddly for her, she realized she somehow longed to be pregnant with Michael's child. Perhaps becoming a mother would serve as the emotional break between her past and her present. She hoped that it would. But there was still work to do. John and Emma would have a honeymoon of exactly one night. Tomorrow, John would join Thorn Rolvag aboard the Dauntless, where they would all work with him in assisting to plant the nuclear charges beneath the sea. Hawaii, Australia, and the few scattered islands where there was human population were all reporting earth tremors of growing magnitude and frequency. As soon as the warheads were in place, John would leave to meet with Dietrich Zimmer and try his desperate gambit. If John did not succeed, the world would die.
I now pronounce you man and wife.
But Emma was part of the family now, and always would be. Sarah still was, even though officially and legally she was no longer. She always would be one of the most heroic women ever to have lived. And John was killing Dietrich Zimmer, not only in order to save the world, but also to avenge Sarah. While exterminating the man who had so cruelly used his first wife, he would be trying desperately to save the life of his second wife. John kissed the bride. Annie cried. Natalia wanted to, but would not. The President of the United States, Arthur Hooks, proposed the toast.
To the Rourke family, past and present and future, and to John Rourke in particular, the nation and its people, the world and all future generations owe to this man a debt which can never be repaid. To the Rourkes!
All who sat around the table in the presidential dining room raised their glasses. Emma felt tears coming to her eyes. She saw Sarah Rourke, and when their eyes met, Sarah took a second sip from her champagne glass and nodded her head toward her. Emma Shaw smiled. The President of the United States was handed a large, flat wooden box, the box itself engraved on the lid with the Great Seal of the United States. John got up from his chair beside her and stood beside the president. The president opened the box lid and tilted the box toward John Rourke and the cameras. Inside the box were two revolvers, the most ornately beautiful handguns she had ever seen, engraving covering every fraction of an inch of the richly blued metal surfaces, tasteful gold embellishment at the muzzles and on the frames. The grips were of richly figured wood, inset within them gold renditions of the Great Seal.
These are Lancer copies, faithful to the last detail, of the Colt Single Action Army 45 with original barrel lengths of 7 1/2 inches. The guns have been painstakingly tuned by Lancer's finest gunsmiths. The wood in the grips was carefully taken from a limb in the first hardwood tree, a black walnut, which was planted after the return of the people of the United States to the land more than a century ago. Without your efforts, that never would have happened, Dr. Rourke. The gold embellishments were mined here, beneath the sea. We felt that the combination was only fitting. And the Lancer people tell me the guns shoot great, too.
John smiled as he took the presentation box, then set it on the table and removed both revolvers, holding them in his hands.
I will treasure these for as long as I live. And if we succeed in those endeavors which still lie before us, these revolvers will be handed down through the generations of my family for as long as the Rourke family exists. If they are ever fired in anger, may that only be in defense of human freedom. Thank you.
They were in an apartment in the married officers' quarters for their wedding night. The formal reception long since over. The informal gathering afterward with the family just concluded. John embraced Sarah. Sarah had kissed him, then kissed Emma.
I wish that every moment for you both will be filled with happiness.
Emma, still wearing her wedding dress, stood in front of the long bedroom mirror, looking at herself. There were a few wrinkles in the fabric and a few hairs were out of place. This was the prettiest she had ever looked, would ever look, she knew. It was the prettiest she would ever feel. And because of that, Emma was reluctant to undress. That was stupid, she knew, on a rational basis, but it was the way she felt. Throughout her life, she'd always considered herself pretty enough, but nothing special. There were more important things to do than look for the perfect shade of lipstick or the perfect shade of makeup. Most of the time, she wore neither. In the last year, she had curled her hair exactly twice, neither time convinced that she had done a decent job of it. Like every woman, she guessed she had a few killer items in her wardrobe. She almost never wore them. And here she was, wearing the prettiest dress she had ever owned and looking the best she would ever look. John, whether he was planning to or not, would take these clothes from her body. She could not bring herself to do so. John entered the bedroom. He had evidently stopped to remove his jacket and to check his guns. The double shoulder holster rig which John normally wore was in one hand, a case with his other pistols in the other. He set them down. He walked across the room toward her.
You're the most beautiful woman in the world.
Yeah, right.
I love you, Emma Rourke.
Undress me.
Rourke kissed her first. Within the data pirated from Dietrich Zimmer's computer network, there was no map, or anything like it, showing the locations of the various canisters of the viral agent. There would be no way of locating and subsequently interdicting their use without the cooperation of Dietrich Zimmer. And that could only be gained by John's being able to outwit the man.
Talk about living on the edge. There's so many variables, and if only one thing goes wrong, the entire human race is destroyed. Except for Zimmer and my wonderful brother Martin.
Paul Rubinstein smiled, saying nothing. Michael's thoughts echoed more or less his own. Following the private family reception, he and Michael had changed to more comfortable clothing and left their wives and retired to one of the small conference rooms, referring to the printouts of the data gleaned from Dietrich Zimmer's computer network and of the conference with Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krauss and the medical and intelligence assessments. The comparatively few medical experts consulted, largely epidemiologists, were of like mind, except for a detail here and there. To a man or woman, they believed that Dietrich Zimmer's plan would work even if only one of the canisters were allowed to discharge its lethal contents into the atmosphere of even a small-sized population center. The only major divergences of opinion among the epidemiologists concerned how long it would actually take for the end of humanity to come. Some gave it 5 years, some gave it a little less. As Paul pored through the data, he reached a frustration point where he was about to stand up, leave the room, and find some place where he could purchase a package of cigarettes.
Nuts!
As Paul stood, his eyes caught something in one of the medical reports.
Holy shit.
What? What's wrong, Paul?
We got him! We got the bastard! He was so damn smart, Zimmer outwitted himself!
What are you talking about?
Think about how fast John was able to recover from the heart transplant. When was the last time you had a cut? How long did it take to heal by comparison to how long it would have taken 6 centuries ago?
I still don't get it, Paul.
Fine. Okay. Think about this, Michael. It says in every one of these analyses of Zimmer's virus that Zimmer's own data shows how the virus mutates. The problem is that it would be impossible to inoculate against every possible mutation. And the one, a dozen, or whatever that you didn't inoculate against would get you. And the virus mutates very rapidly. I got a gut feeling about this. I know it could be done. I know it.
What if we... Hell, let's go wake up Professor Dr. Krause. She can tell us, I bet.
Tell us what?
And if I'm right, Zim is out of the genocide business. Come on, Michael.
Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krause stood in her doorway, looking at them very oddly.
Do you two young men realize the hour?
Yes, ma'am. And we're really sorry to disturb you. I am. Well, okay, we're both sorry, but it was my idea. I need your input. If I'm wrong, you could shoot me down.
Shoot you down?
I mean, if my idea is all wet, a dumb idea. You'll be able to tell me in a split second, I'm sure. But if I'm right, I think we got the way to defeat Dietrich Zimmer's virus, his Omega option.
Come in, young man.
Thank you, ma'am.
The doctor wore the kind of old flannel bathrobe he would have thought nobody made anymore, and her hair was up in curlers, covered with a hairnet. She sat down on the overstuffed chair, just perching on the edge of it, her hands neatly folded, palms upward in her lap. With a nod, she gestured them to the couch, and Paul closed his eyes for a moment, organizing his thoughts. He opened his eyes. Her pretty eyes went wide as he started to explain.
I think, Fraulein Doctor, that the way to defeat Dietrich Zimmer is right at hand. There wouldn't be time to make up inoculants which would defeat one fatal mutation after another, let alone disseminate them to every human being on the planet. And even if John Rourke succeeds in getting Zimmer to divulge the location of the canisters containing the virus, what if Zimmer were to intentionally leave out even one of them? We'd all just be dead.
All of us except Zimmer and Martin, that is, and their clones. Because they have been inoculated against the virus in all its possible mutations.
That's right. And unless Zimmer made up an antiviral cocktail over the course of a decade or so, most of the epidemiologists think the virus will die out within about 8 years. Zimmer's own computer models proclaim that it will take 10 years for the virus to mutate itself out of existence. So how did he get the means to make the inoculation which will keep him and Martin Zimmer and their clones safe? He had to have found a way to accelerate the mutation process in the laboratory, right?
If we could obtain a sample of the virus, it might be possible for our scientists to devise exactly the same inoculant in as short a period of time, or even less. We would have the same advantage which Dr. Zimmer had, knowing the exact nature of the virus. And instead of frantically developing the means by which to defeat each and every manifestation of the virus, we could inoculate against the virus in all its forms at once.
There's another possible thing. And it's so obvious. That's why we didn't think of it. Because it was right there in front of our eyes. If we could grab, kidnap, snatch, Shanghai, Dietrich Zimmer, or Martin Zimmer, or even one of their clones, their blood could be used to synthesize a serum against the disease. Couldn't it, Fraulein Doctor? Huh?
With even a small sample of Dr. Zimmer's blood, we could save days or weeks or months of research. We would have the serum almost instantly. It would be possible by utilizing every available facility within the Trans-Global Alliance to produce a sufficient amount of the serum so that everyone in the world could be inoculated against the disease. We would start with the most densely populated areas first, of course, and move out into the more rural areas where there was less danger. We could defeat the Doctor.
Defeat was a much more polite word than the one Paul Rubinstein had in mind, but it captured the spirit of the thing well enough. It was as if a great weight had been lifted from his shoulders, and John Rourke embraced his friend, then took a step and clasped Paul's hand.
President Hook should have given you those pistols.
All in a day's work for a faithful Jewish companion. Or a night's work, I should say.
The observation deck overlooking one of the sea walls of the dome was an exceptionally beautiful place. Sea life of every possible description flourished above and below and in front of them, as in an enormous aquarium. But instead of the sea life looking out and the humans looking in, the situation was reversed. The men and women of Midway lived within what amounted to a gigantic terrarium, maintaining a surface environment beneath the sea. Emma, hair pinned up loosely, wearing what looked like an enormous white t-shirt, a near ankle-length full skirt of blue denim and sandals, leaned up and kissed Paul.
I guess I can do that now.
You're the prettiest stepmother-in-law a man could ask for. And the nicest, too.
The whole perspective of this thing has changed. We don't need Zimmer's cooperation on a willing basis. We can grab Zimmer and Martin. We can get the blood samples we need. If we have Zimmer, it probably won't be possible for the virus to be released. Through hypnosis or whatever means necessary, we can extract the information. And we'll have the time to do so because we'll have a serum which can combat the disease. We'll still have to find the canisters because eventually they'll leak, as we discussed, and it'd be nice not to have to inoculate the next 10 generations against it. Although we can if we have to, if there's no way of getting Zimmer to divulge the information. What we'll need is as much time as we can get to develop the serum. I propose this. The clones of Zimmer and Martin, those which survived, have been inoculated as the data obtained from Zimmer's computer network tells us. If we can get to the clones and make it look as though we were after something else besides a blood sample, we might be able to get the jump on Zimmer and have the serum in preparation, possibly even disseminated on a limited basis before he realized what was happening. It's dangerous that way, but if the release system has to be something to which he constantly attends, say in order to keep the virus from releasing, which would make good sense on his part as a failsafe against his own destruction, then the virus might be released automatically. So, we have to gamble that Zimmer won't release the virus while Thorn Robog's project is underway, but probably immediately after Thorn succeeds. So if Thorn is hard at work, planning the charges and readying them to detonate, we could use that same time to create the serum.
We'll need to locate the clones, get in on some pretext, get the samples, and get out in such a way that he doesn't suspect our real purpose.
Yes, indeed. But how? We're gonna have to think about that one. So, we join Thorn Robog on his research vessel. Help him however we can. Meanwhile, we're working to locate the clones which still survive and come up with a way of getting at them. As unobtrusively as possible, we recruit laboratory research facilities and the best qualified people we can find to use them. I think Professor Dr. Krauss would be the logical person to head up that latter effort, wouldn't you agree?
Perfect for it.
Rourke looked at his wife. Emma nodded agreement.
Fine. We should make the most of every moment, Paul. Get Michael to coordinate with Darkwood and Emma's dad, too. He's still at Midwake?
Yeah, I think so.
He was going to take the shuttle after lunch today.
Great. He's got a good tactical head. Put together as versatile a team of personnel as we can muster so we'll have all the right people for whatever type of tactical situation we can expect to encounter once we locate the clones. Get Darkwood and his people on that right away. And get Annie to stick with him and keep him moving on it. Help however she can with it. Have her also start marshaling any kind of equipment she can think of that we'll need. She can liaise between Darkwood and the intel people and you and Natalia. I want you and Natalia to work out scenarios we can employ once we get the location, and then work out an outline of the tactical requirements for the operation. Emma, start coming up with all the air support options we might require. Figure the equipment, line it up, and have it waiting so we can take the equipment and personnel we'll need, whatever those requirements turn out to be, at essentially a moment's notice. If there are any major aircraft-related aspects to the operation beyond basic transportation, I'd like you to take personal charge of that. I can get you whatever authorization you'll need, just let me know. We'll need air cover, possibly, or diversionary actions, perhaps specialized types of aircraft, so get on that. We're gonna do this. Omega option my ass.
You take the controls on three.
John Rourke took the yoke. They were a mere 500 yards out of the carrier-like docking bay at Midwake when Rourke had the controls. He had watched Emma, studied how the controls worked, convinced himself that flying a dual-environment craft through water wasn't much different from flying a single-environment craft through the air. That was a little overly optimistic, he realized, but as he aimed the V-Stall's nose toward the water surface above, he knew that he had it. He wasn't as smooth as Emma was with it, and doubted that he ever would be, but he was doing it. They broke surface, the sun bright, and Rourke's eyes squinted against it, despite the windshield's self-adjusting light transference. The feeling of freedom was magnificent. The V-Stall's controls were the most responsive of any aircraft he had ever flown. Piloting the aircraft was, to John Rourke's thinking, perhaps the closest man would come to flying, actually flying unaided.
You're doing great, John.
You're too kind. Can I keep the controls for a while?
As long as you want. You need to fly one of the new Blackbirds. If this gets you hard, that would be better.
Faster, I know, but as responsive?
Oh, yeah. Once they make them so they're capable of both environments, like these babies,
Flying one would be the next best thing to sex.
Now that would be impossible.
I only said the next best thing, remember?
What's our course, Commander?
Already laid in, General. Just follow the heads up. And watch those banking maneuvers. I just had lunch.
Aye, aye.
John Rourke felt invigorated. Despite what lay ahead, a final confrontation with Dietrich Zimmer, perhaps the final confrontation forever, he felt alive. He had just begun life again, no matter how little of life might remain to him, and the essence of life is to be aware of living. He was that.
I love you.
Why did you say that, John? I'm glad you did, and I like it when you say it. But why did you say it right now, at this instant?
This is why.
He pulled back gently on the yoke, the V-stall's nose rising.
And I know we're off course, but I had to do this.
Rourke started the V-stall toward the sun. In a few seconds, he would turn back on course, but only after a few seconds.
I understand you, John Rourke. I think I really understand you.
As the sun began setting and the ocean water beneath began darkening, he could, in places where the water was clearer occasionally, see just the faintest glow. That would be the trench and the volcanic activity within it, where the depth of the trench was less than the average. Fire, burning within the water, like a living organism of indeterminate yet malevolent nature, but beautiful. He was aware that he was looking at death, too. But only if mankind failed and nature won. In the closing years of the 20th century, many people spoke of man learning to live in harmony with nature. That the planet should be cared for, protected, was only logical. But man had never lived in harmony with nature. He conquered nature, or nature conquered him. Man could not live in harmony with elements which, by their very essence, were inharmonious with human existence. Nature brought rain and cold and darkness. Man found shelter and heat and light. Hurricanes and tornadoes assaulted man's structures. Man built stronger and more wisely, and when nature won, man rebuilt. Harmony was a fallacy. He could see the death and beauty in the suboceanic vent, finding nothing contradictory in either. They were nearing the Dauntless, Rolvag's research vessel from which all efforts against the vent were now coordinated. Aircraft and ships even now ferried the world's tactical nuclear warheads to aid in the effort. Soon, the battle between man and nature would be joined. To live in harmony with nature now would mean to accept death.
Take the controls, please. Landing a V-Sto with my limited experience might be a little dangerous for all concerned. More than a little dangerous.
All right, but you could do it if you had to.
Probably, but it wouldn't be prudent to set out to prove that at this very moment.
On three. One, two, three.
On three, John Rourke released the controls, his eyes going toward the flotilla again. The Dauntless was as large as a 20th century oil tanker, but utilized the hydrofoil principle and, comparatively speaking, could start and stop on a dime. The dime over which it had stopped was surrounded by various other vessels, some of them clearly deep-dive submersibles, tethered to the Dauntless itself, others surface-going warships. And there was one submersible carrier vessel, only partially surfaced.
That's the Paladin, John. The Paladin will be our home base. We'll land there, then transfer to the Dauntless by helicopter or submersible whaleboat. Whatever's handiest and available.
Now you've got me on that one. What's a submersible whaleboat?
Mini-sub, fully surface-capable, hydrofoil type. Kind of fun to pilot one, really. And yes, I'll let you try it.
When he had delegated tasks to the family, he had left one task for himself. That was to make a prearranged contact with Otto Kroenberg. He was doing that now.
If you want to rule your people, both those within the Nazi movement and the people of Eden, meet me at these coordinates however you can. If you'll require transport, let me know.
Rourke gave the coordinates for the Dauntless.
I would be broadcasting my complicity with you.
Hopefully not, but if it means that, so be it. This is your chance not only to live, but to rule, if you play it right.
Kroenberg agreed and would rendezvous with them at the Dauntless in less than 1 hour if all had gone well. Rourke climbed into what would correspond to a co-pilot's seat within the whaleboat, Emma in the pilot's seat. It was like a ride at an amusement park. One sat in the whaleboat, the boat in a narrow channel of water, on either side of the channel heavy bumpers to protect the exterior of the whaleboat. Then the upper portion of the whaleboat was closed, cocoon-like, and the whaleboat started ahead along the channel. When it reached a certain point, it began to descend, within seconds fully submerged in a pool with an enclosed top. The whaleboat then moved toward various ports at the far side of the pool, passing one of these and entering the open sea. The Dauntless was not a submersible, nor was it equipped for below waterline ingress or egress, so Emma began surfacing the whaleboat. The tiny craft broke surface.
Watch this, John. Look to one side or the other.
John Rourke looked to port, the vessel rising over the surface as the framework for a hydrofoil unfolded from the whaleboat's hull. He quickly turned his head to the right, looking over the starboard side. The framework unfolded there as well, the craft rising, then rocketing ahead, nearly flying over the water.
Generally, the smaller the vessel, the more the effect when you go up.
I wish this were open, Tom.
Your wish is my command. Look out. It's a rush.
It was indeed invigorating.
Don't worry, John. These things are made to run with the cockpit open or closed. If we had high seas, the craft would automatically bail itself, but we'd be soaked. Just enjoy the ride.
He was enjoying the ride, literally and figuratively.